Peterbury Rib too. Now, we're talking, we're going to go back to the issue of daily routine. So how would your day start?
Ravalli was about 6:30, something like that, and one got out of bed without much problem. There was no tearing about with bullying by sergeants or anything like that. We got up. I think we had time to shave and wash. We went down to breakfast, which was, I can't remember, quite a long way away. We had quite a long walk to get to the wherever breakfast was. And then I should think...
Can we spin off with breakfast? What was the food like this? I mean, you'd had sort of, you'd lots of institutional food at the schools, but what did you think of army food generally? That's your first experience of it really at Catterick. I mean, breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
What was the food like?
I thought army food was very good. It was certainly plain. It was wholesome. There was lots of it. It didn't worry me at all. There was cooked breakfast every morning. There was, I can't remember whether we had toast and marmalade or anything, but we had good mugs of tea, of course, all the time, pint mugs of tea. And it was okay.
How did it compare with public school food? I mean, how did it compare with the Malvern?
Not much different, really. I mean, I suppose...
Not worse?
No, I don't think it was any worse. No, I mean, there was probably not so much variety as there was at school. But I was used to plain, wholesome food. I mean, after all, don't forget, I was a teenager. I was coming up through the war where there wasn't a lot of food anyway. I mean, so I wasn't coming from rich background of food in any shape or form anyway. So it was okay.
So after breakfast?
Parade. Learning the rudiments of drill.
Can we ask about drill? Because you've obviously done drill. At
yeah, exactly.
How did you take generally to drill? And also, did you understand at that time the point of it? Not now, or, you know, but at the time, did you understand drill, why you were doing it, what it was for?
Yes, I did, because that had been... forgive the pun, drilled into me at Malvern as well as to what it was all about. It was about discipline, it was about coordination, it was about cohesion, it was about being fit, it was about building morale, esprit de corps, all those things. And I'd certainly understood that from the age of about 13 or 14 onwards when I was at Malvern. As far as drill was concerned in the army, there was no problem for me at all, because I knew how to do it for a start. I mean, I knew how to march in step, I knew how to about turn, I knew how to left turn and right turn, I knew how to salute, I knew all these things, and I had a huge advantage over a lot of the blokes who were in the squad who simply didn't know where they were at all. I suppose, I don't think it would be lying to say I probably enjoyed it. I mean, you know, there was no effort involved, really. I mean, I was reasonably fit anyway. I was used to wearing boots and gaiters and all the rest of it. So there was no real problem. There was a lot of hilarious moments. Such as when we had to take the squad ourselves. That was a little bit later on. Some of the people taking the squad, of course, made a complete nonsense of it, and there was left wheeling when you should have right wheeled, and so on and so forth. And there were some uncomfortable moments when one was doing it in the rain and it was cold. I was lucky at Catterick. I went there in the middle of May and I left in the middle of September. It was very cold in the middle of May and it was very cold in the middle of September, but we did at least have the summer up there, so we were very lucky in that sense.
Now, so you have drill sessions. Now, other sessions you might have in your typical morning.
PT.
What kinds of physical training and did it actually work? Did it actually improve you? Because you just come out of school, you liked sport.
Yeah.
You weren't great at it, but you liked it.
Yeah.
What was the sort of physical training program from
It was formal stuff with arms bend, knees bend, you know, all the usual sort of formal stuff in a squad. Certain amount of running. we did cross-country runs, which, again, I had no problem with at all. I mean, some of the blokes nearly died doing these things because they weren't fit at all. I enjoyed cross-country running. I had no problems with it. I was physically quite fit. We did boxing training. I didn't like boxing. I never did like boxing, and I avoided it at school. I saw no reason to hit anybody else in the face. And I used to find somebody to box with who agreed with me that we wouldn't aim at each other's faces at all. We'd just hit each other on the chest. And that was quite easily done. And one used to sort of keep out of the way as far as possible. Rope climbing we did. I wasn't very good at that either. I didn't have very strong wrists, I don't think. And I didn't really, not very good on the rope. But the rest of it was no problem at all, really. And I can't remember the detail of PT at all,
did
I'm afraid.
Did it improve your fitness level, do you think, or did it?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I was certainly not that fit, having just done 6 months' work in London sitting behind a desk all the time, although I was playing rugby all through the winter, so I wasn't totally unfit. I mean, it improved my fitness level, yes, even more, certainly hardened up.
Now, other sessions at weapons training, I mean, simple weapons training. Can we start with a rifle? You could already fire the rifle, but
yep.
What was the sort of training you got on the 303? I presume, yes,
well,
not SLR.
303, yes, at Lee Enfield, yeah. It was, well, I was familiar with it. I knew how to take it to bits, I knew how to take the belt, I knew how to clean it, I knew where the 4x2, I knew what 4x2 was, I knew where it was kept, and in the little thing at the back, bottom of the butt, and I knew how to load a magazine with 303 blanks or bullets, and basically, we went right back, obviously, to the beginning, because the three-quarters of the squad had never seen one in their lives, and they had to be taught how to do it right from the start, so one coasted through it very easily. One was very fortunate to have done these things before, you know.
That's the rifle.
That was the rifle. Then we had Sten gun as well.
Now tell me about the Sten gun.
Now, yeah, and I've read more about the Sten since then, of course, so that it was the most unloved weapon in the army, I think, in the war. We didn't know anything about how unloved it was and how easily it jammed. We rather enjoyed the Sten. It was a nice little machine gun with a magazine on the left-hand side, and we actually got to fire them. Once or twice, which I did quite well at targets and the butts and so on and so forth, and didn't have any problem with it.
There's two things that are raised about the Sten normally. One is that its size of bullet and range are such that you might as well have thrown it at someone.
Yes.
It really had a... I mean, what range could you fire it accurately at?
I think in the butts we fired it at about 25 yards, not much more. Yeah, and there were sort of targets of, you know, cutouts of people sticking up the other end. Things
but
like
you
that.
Could hit at that range.
Yeah, oh yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
And the second point was, were you told that if you dropped it, it would go off? Because that's the other big thing about Stens.
Whether we were actually told that or not, I don't know. But I know that the efficiency on the range was very well controlled. I mean, the sergeants, and not surprisingly, the permanent staff who looked after us were scared stiff of these young men holding these things with live information. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, sergeant. That's it was very strictly done. And if anybody did do anything silly or dropped it, they would get a very severe bollocking, certainly. Nobody was charged, I don't think, on things like that. We didn't have sort of jankers and things like that on basic training because they were interested in training everybody, of course, and not people falling behind.
And safety on the range is
safety on the range was with any weapon was well controlled, and red flags and all the rest of it, and it was well properly done. Yeah.
What about other weapons? I should have asked with the rifle. Did you do any bayonet training?
Yes, we did. I hadn't done that before, and we learned how to use the bayonet, and we charged at things of sacking hanging from strings on gantries and so on and so forth, and had to scream our heads off like Japanese soldiers and so on and so forth. I mean, it was considered a bit of a lark. I mean, it wasn't really taken terribly seriously. But one learned how to put it on, how to take it off. One had to clean it, of course, and bull it up and so on and so forth. They weren't very sharp.
Did they teach you bayonet fencing, which is sort of, you know...
No.
One against one and bringing the butt
no.
over, this sort of stuff?
No, we weren't taught that at all.
So it's just sticking a sack?
Yes, no, we weren't... that's right, yeah. No, we weren't taught defence procedures with bayonets at all, no.
Now, other weapons...
Bren. Yeah, we were introduced to the Bren. I don't think so, no. And I think I had to learn the Bren from scratch in the army and about how to take it to pieces. And I remember the gas regulator on the front where you could turn it round to increase the amount of gas if it wasn't firing properly and things like that. Well, I'd learned how to take it, how to strip it and put it together again. Whether we fired it or not at that stage, I'm not sure. I think we probably did, but I did more of that when I got out to Hong Kong.
Well,
but,
we'll come back to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Other, I mean, did you learn any of the lines?
Yes, two-inch mortar.
Tell me about that.
Two-inch mortar, well, very simple instrument, of course, the two-inch mortar. I think we fired smoke. I don't think we fired anything, any HE, high explosive mortar. We fired smoke, I think, out on the ranges a few times, but a very simple instrument. And
was it easy to...
I mean, simple.
It's quite, there's nothing to aim really with it.
It was a crude weapon. I mean, it had a calibration on the left hand side for which was meant to be able to tell you how far in terms how vertical you should be for different distances and so on. And somebody used to make sure you hadn't got the thing absolutely vertical so that your smoke bomb would come down on your head, things like that. I mean, you know, but it was a very simple, crude instrument, but very effective.
Any anti-tank, the Piat or anything?
No, no Piats. Never saw a Piat in my life.
Any other anti-tank weapon?
No.
Any other weapons you can think of? I can't think of any.
No,
oh,
I can't.
Hand grenades, sorry.
Yeah, I think we did hand grenades at basic training. Can't remember anything about it, no, except that I suppose one threw dummies most of the time. I don't think we threw live ones.
So your day's sessions might be drill, PT and weapons training.
Yeah.
Anything else you were learning in that sort of first 3 months?
4 weeks.
No,
that was it, really. That was basically
it. So that's
it.
How your day would be split up,
yes,
into sessions.
Yes, we had lectures on, basic lectures on, I haven't got a note of it there. I don't think I have. I might have. Let me just have a quick look. We had lectures on things like the Commonwealth and the United Nations. Pistols, we did pistols as well. That was the other weapon we did. Fired stens. We did map reading.
Let's go back to... So let's take the lectures.
This is answering your question. This is in the first 4 weeks, you know.
So
yeah.
The lectures, what they'd be, were they just on sort of current affairs? Or
Yes, I think mainly, apart from map reading and things like that. We did intelligence tests when we first went in. There was obviously a lot of bullying going on. I mean, the other activity was bullying.
What about pistol? Tell me about pistol training then.
Can't remember very much about it. I mean, I can't even remember. Was it Smith and Wesson? I don't know. Can't remember what it was, but I can't remember much about it.
Now, if we move into the evening phase, then the next thing is sort of like preparing ball and preparing for kit inspections.
Yep.
Now, tell me about how you'd prepare for a kit inspection. How did you get your uniform into a state? What level of ball was going on?
Well, at the beginning, one was issued with belt and gaiters, and the brasses were new. They were new belts and gaiters. The brasses were new. They were very rough, and one had to get them into a very shiny state very shortly, and one was... one took advice on how to do that, and you used sandpaper, you used cardboard soaked in brasso and rubbed it very hard against the cardboard, which was the best way of getting the brass, which is a soft metal, of course, brass, but you had to make sure you did the backs of the belt buckles and as well as the front and the sides and inside the little buckles and so on and so forth. And that was a serious business, and a lot of time was spent on bullying, things like that. It's mainly belts and gaiters, of course. And boots as well. I think we had... Did we have best boots? I think we must have had best boots. I think we had two pairs, yes. And can't remember it in basic training as being a serious scientific business like it was when I went further on down the line, which we'll come to, of course.
Okay. So, And what was a kit inspection like? I mean, how rigorous was it?
It
was a kit and room inspection.
Yeah, a kit and room inspection. One had to lay one's kit out, and one had to learn how to fold one's blankets absolutely perfectly so that no edges were showing. And you had to put your cup and your plate and your knives and forks, which were all well built up, in exactly the right position on the bed, and the boots in the right position, and the locker door was open, and your other kit was all... And that was very seriously done, and you got into terrible trouble if there was anything very badly out of alignment, and so on and so forth. And those inspections would take place by one's troop corporal, platoon corporal, we were platoons in those days, I think. And, were we troops? No, we must have been troops because we were in the RAC. And, or by the sergeant, or by a lieutenant, and occasionally by a major. You know, I mean, they went up and down the scale.
What was their reaction to real or imagined faults? I mean, there's different scales from the simple admonition, you know, to the.
If you were in trouble and they found four or five things wrong with you, then they would start chucking it about. And you would be on a parade later that evening and tomorrow morning to show it again. You didn't get away with it. Having said that, there were times when you thought you were going to be inspected and nobody turned up to do it. You know? I mean, that happened probably more frequently, and the great sighs of relief. And of course, we also had to bull the barrack room. The floor had to be polished, the beds had to be polished, the windows had to be cleaned, a bit of whitewash here and there where it was needed, and so on and so forth. I mean, the lampshades, if they had dust on them, you know, somebody was in big trouble, and you took it in turns to be in charge of the room, so that it was your responsibility if anybody else did anything wrong, and so on. So there was a certain amount of... if you like, leadership work going on there in terms of making you responsible for everybody else and taking it to terms to do things like that. But, no, there was a high state of bull went on.
And how did you take it? Because there's different ways of reacting to bull. You can go along with it, you can enthusiastically embrace it, or you can kick against it.
I cooperated. I did it all because I thought, well, you know, I think you've got to do it. And it seemed to me that I knew... this was going to happen. I mean, I knew other people who'd had to do it before and so on. I mean, a lot of the blokes, whom we called nignogs, of course, grumbled ceaselessly about it and were always... There were always a few blokes always getting into trouble who just couldn't cope with it and so on. But, of course, they were conscripts. They weren't volunteers. I mean, they couldn't be chucked out. So they just had a miserable life, I suppose. But I mean, I had enough common sense to realise that if I wanted to avoid a miserable life, I better cooperate and do it. You know, so I did.
Did you start to enjoy it? Because some people definitely start to enjoy it, No,
I don't think I really ever enjoyed it. I'd rather have laid on my bed and slept, I think, or listened to music or something like that. I didn't enjoy it, but it had to be done, and it had to be done very often till quite late at night when you were a bit tired and didn't really want to do it, you know.
Now tell me how you got on with the other lads. First, we'll talk about the NCOs and the officers, but yeah. the lads, your other recruits.
Well, that was, I think, quite an interesting story, because when we joined on the first day, I was in a hut, as I said, probably with about 25 other blokes, and no less than 7 of them were old Etonians, which was really not quite demographically balanced, was it? And most of the others were Durham miners. So there was a huge contrast of types of people. The Etonians were cliquey, and all knew each other anyway. They were very cliquey. Not all of them were snobbish. Some of them were rather snobbish. 3 or 4 of them, at least, I did not get on well with at all. 2 or 3 of the others, I became quite friendly, and I went around with them and so on and so forth. And they, I mean, you know, as far as they were concerned, I came from a very, very minor public school, and was more than, where the hell's that, and all this sort of stuff, you know. I mean, they didn't like it. The Durham miners, we gradually got to know them, and they were great blokes and so on and so forth. I mean, didn't like them all, obviously, but some of them were hideous. But But in a curious sort of English way, morale, in fact, started to be built quite quickly because we were all in it together and we were all doing the same things and so on and so forth, you know.
Did you get close to any of the Durham miners, or was it just to the two or three?
They weren't all Durham miners. I'm exaggerating slightly, of course, when I say that.
Did you get close to them? As close to them as, say, you got to the two or three?
Not really, no. I don't think one ever went down to Camp Centre with any of them, you know, because, you know, one had other... You picked your friends and you stayed with the same as people do. You stayed with your same blokes, really, you know.
And your friends were a couple of the Eton lads.
Yeah, and there were one or two other public school boys around, I think, and so on and so forth, you know. I mean, but we had a high proportion of public school blokes, I think, in our wing, you know.
And was that in any way deliberate? Because you should only have had... There should only really have been you by the law of averages.
By the law of averages, indeed. I don't know. I mean, whether it was accidental or not, I don't know. Whether it was done... I mean, I don't think it was alphabetical. I mean... The other blokes, they didn't have names beginning A, B, and C or anything like that. There was a chap called Fairbairn, a very tall man, who I got quite friendly with. And there were a few A's and B's. Now, maybe it was alphabetical, I don't know.
What were the terrible Durham miners? In what way were they terrible for you? What didn't you like about them? The ones you... I accept you've gone mostly with most of them, but what were the terrible ones like?
They smoked in bed. First thing I did in the morning was to roll over and light a fag. I smoked as well, but I didn't smoke in bed. I didn't smoke before breakfast either. They were dirty. They swore absolutely non-stop. I mean, we all swore, you know, but... it wasn't sort of fuck every word like it was with them. I mean, they simply could not express themselves without fuck this and fuck that all the time. You know, I mean, it just happened. I mean, one got used to it, really. I mean, one wasn't shocked by it or anything like that, for heaven's sake. I mean, you know, we'd all been around a bit. I can't remember anything specific about them that was really unpleasant. Don't know. Didn't really drink with them. I don't think they. I don't think they came.
Didn't roll back drunk.
No, I don't. There was very little drunkenness because none of us really had any money. I mean, the Etonians obviously had private money, but I didn't have any extra money at all. I mean, I think Father gave me 10 shillings when I went out on the first day. You know, which was a 10 bob note I had. You know, terrific. And but I didn't drink very much. I didn't have any money. I mean, I bought cigarettes and things like that. I learned to smoke in the army.
Well, tell me about that. Well, why did you start?
Because there was at 10 to the hour, if you were out on a march or wherever you were, there was a smoke break. And the rule in the army, there is a smoke break. Right, smoke break, they used to say. So you smoked. And if you didn't, you weren't a sort of sissy, particularly if you didn't. But I mean, people smoked, so I started smoking, you know. And with other people offered me a cigarette, and I had one. I offered them one, and red tins of Du Maurier, which didn't get crushed in your pocket when you lay down.
Now, what about? We'll have to talk about the sergeant's day, but what about the other recreations? I mean, how would you spend? Your free time, not that you have a lot of free time on basic training.
Lying on my bed, reading, sleeping. I had a wireless, which I was allowed to have, and I loved classical music. And I used to listen to the Brahms in the evenings and things like that from July onwards, and I used to listen to as much classical music as I could. I had no headphones or anything. I had to have it on fairly quiet because other people didn't like it very much. But we did nothing, except for we went down to Camp Centre and we went to our local cinema as well, wherever that was. I went to an enormous number of films. My diary shows that I probably went to 3 or 4 films in a week, and I wasn't really a film goer. And, I mean, I could read you a list of some of the films, which, of course, I'm not going to do. Some of the films we saw, I mean, Betty Grable and all sorts of Singing in the Rain and wonderful films. Some of them were very good. Went to a lot of films.
There was a camp cinema, or is this
There were two. We had a cinema near us, which I think was called The Globe, which had films about once a week, I think, just at the weekend.
Is that a commercial cinema?
No, it was an army cinema. And there was one in Camp Centre. Is quite a sophisticated place. I mean, it's got a big parade ground. It's got a lovely cricket pitch. It's got shops and a naffy, a big naffy club, a proper brick buildings and so on and so forth, and a proper big brick cinema in Camp Centre and Kettering. And we used to, there was a bus we could get down there and back. I mean, it was about 2 miles away, Camp Centre. And there was a bus that we used to get down, and we could get it back at 11 o'clock at night after going to the cinema.
And what about the naffy? Did you go to the naffy? Oh,
frequently. And the YMCA, there were two.
What did the canteens, both the canteens offer? I mean, obviously the YMCA wouldn't be, that'd be dry, wouldn't it? No alcohol.
I think it probably was, yes. I can't remember that. I think you're right.
What was the atmosphere like in the canteen, the naffy canteen, say?
I can remember very little about it, in fact. I mean, I think the staff were mainly middle-aged ladies behind the counters, and they were cheerful and nice, and there were sort of Parker Knoll-type chairs which one could sit about in, and you could get a pint of beer what the cost of it was, but it was cheap. It was probably cheaper than going to a civilian pub, I think.
Did I drink much?
As much as I possibly could, yes, on the limited foreign funds that I had. But, I mean, we're talking about these early days, aren't we, the first 4 or 5 weeks, and I doubt if I ever had more than 2 or 3 pints in an evening, so I certainly never got pissed during these early days.
And tell us a bit more about how you got on with your instructors, both your troop NCOs and also the sort of general instructors. What were they like, these guys?
Yeah, they were good. On the whole, they were good blokes, and I don't think they wanted to be there really. But they were all right. The sergeants were okay. One or two of them were actually quite friendly. One or two of them were quite lazy, and didn't always turn up. The junior officers very often didn't turn up, but they were quite friendly once they realised that you were a potential officer yourself, and then they could actually talk to you and so on and so forth. They're probably nicer to us than the other blokes. I mean, you know, we had various captains and lieutenants, and we met the colonel once, Colonel Close, and so on. And we had our chap in charge of our wing was called Captain Millcrease. And he was quite a civilised bloke. He was quite a nice man. And he used to come out on schemes with us, and was about quite a lot. They were quite a friendly lot, really.
Now, you just mentioned schemes. We haven't done. Did you do tactical exercises in your basic training, or is that a bit later?
I don't think so, no.
Right. So what happened at the end?
Well, the basic training, in fact, was meant to be 5 weeks, but POs, potential officers, only did 4 weeks of it. We were off that after 4 weeks. And we then moved to a thing called the PO wing. And I can't remember much about that, except that I think it was slightly more civilised. We were still in a dormitory situation, still in a spider. And we started a thing called the leadership course. And
the leadership course
was with this Captain Millcrease, and we started doing things like AFV recognition, lecture techniques. There were still doing fatigues and things like that, and I volunteered to look after the spider boiler, which you should never do, of course, in the army, is volunteer. But it appealed to me to have that job to do. And I never got any other fatigues. I never peeled a potato in my whole life in the army. And all sorts of other things that people had to do at nasty times of day, I got out of because I was in charge of the boiler.
What did that entail then?
It entailed filling it up and emptying it of ash twice a day, once in the early morning and once in the evening. Polishing any brass taps that there were about and making it all look tiddly. And I made it look much tiddlier than it was when I took it over. And making sure we had enough coal and all of that. I enjoyed it because we always had hot water. And that appealed to me, you know. And people were pleased with me because they always had hot water and things like that. Used an awful lot of coal as a result of it, but that wasn't paying for it, was it? Lecture on organisation of the armoured regiment. Things like that. Lectures on appreciation and orders, communications drills. Do you know what communications drills are? That's being on the square, that's drill on the square, but being at the far end of the square and having to shout your orders over about 100 yards to make sure you get heard. And an awful lot of shouting went on, and that was all quite fun.